I'll be returning your tests when we take a break. I've got a note to myself here that says return the test, because sometimes I get so lost in what I want to tell you that I forget things like that. So I've got this note, plus now that I've told you I intend to do that, I know you're not going to let me forget. The way I return tests is I spread them out from this end of the stage, left to right, alphabetized by your last name. So if your last name starts with an A, you'd start over here at the extreme left and find your test. They're folded in a way, they're folded in a way that you can find your name, but it doesn't show your score. The reason I like to do it at the break is because more people have arrived by then, and I at least have your attention for the first hour. So, may I have your attention, please, as we return to the learning objectives. I'll back up just enough to let you know the last thing done. Should I have your attention, please? Thank you. We last did learning objective 8B, where we connected what you see in this picture here to the turning on of glycolysis in adipocytes. We're talking about glucagon messages in the fasting state. And the two main target tissues that listen to glucagon messages are adipocytes and liver cells. And I wanted to give you some examples of how glucagon messages influence activities in those two types of cells in the fasting state. And in Objective 8B, we dealt with adipocytes, which speed up glycolysis. And that's really all there is for me to tell you about glucagon messages to adipocytes. Glucagon tells adipocytes to speed up lipolysis in a way that I think you now understand very well. You've been introduced to hormone-sensitive lipase and how it is activated by a phosphorylation, which is catalyzed by protein kinase A. And you can connect this to glucagon signals. We accomplished that on Tuesday. Now for Objective 8C, I'm going to talk about how what you see in this diagram can be connected to the speeding up of gluconeogenesis in liver cells, the other kind of target cells for glucagon messages. So it'll be about how glucagon messages lead to speeding up of gluconeogenesis in liver cells. But let me say already that that's not nearly all there is to glucagon messages to liver cells. Glucagon messages to liver cells speed up gluconeogenesis not only in the way I'm going to talk about right now, but in some other ways that I'll talk about later. And also, glucagon messages to liver cells, I hope this will make sense to you, glucagon messages to liver cells not only speed up gluconeogenesis, but also speed up the breakdown of liver glycogen, glycogenolysis. And later on, we'll talk about how that happens. So I'm not trying to do all of that today. I'm not trying to explain all that there is to explain about glucagon messages to liver cells in the fasting state today. But I'm only biting off a little piece of that to show you one of the ways that glucagon messages to liver cells in the fasting state speeds up gluconeogenesis. How they speed up gluconeogenesis. And so remember, glucagon sits down on a glucagon receptor, and that leads to this enzyme coming on, adenylate cyclase, which creates cyclic AMP as the second messenger. That's as far as we've gotten in this diagram. And then we started talking about what the cyclic AMP does next in glucagon messages. And it always leads to, glucagon messages always lead to, what happens next is protein kinase A turns on. But then, glucagon stories can diverge depending on what proteins are next phosphorylated in reactions catalyzed by protein kinase A. Protein kinase A was introduced on Tuesday as an enzyme that catalyzes phosphorylations of proteins. And that changes how well those proteins do their jobs. And we only touched the tip of the iceberg as far as proteins that will be phosphorylated by protein kinase A. hormone-sensitive lipase, I guess, is the only example I've given you thus far of proteins phosphorylated by protein kinase A. And that's what happens in adipocytes. But now let's talk about liver cells and begin talking about some of the proteins in liver cells that would be phosphorylated by protein kinase A. And I'm not going to tell you about them all in this one lecture, but I'll tell you about one of them right now, and this is for objective 8C. And this is a good illustration of how signal transduction mechanisms involving second messengers, in other words, involving first messengers that never even enter the target cells, hormones that never even enter the target cells, how this can all lead to a change in gene expression in the target cell. And to remind you of what gene expression is, I drew this and I made it available on the portal to give you some basic information about transcription, which happens in a cell's nucleus, and then translation, which happens at a ribosome. I've attempted to talk about those things in class already, and it really hasn't elicited very many questions from you guys, so I'm thinking this goes pretty well with you. If that's not true, let me know. Don't hide from me. This is available in the portal, and I'll leave it up for a while longer here today. You see, the first part of gene expression is transcription, where there are instructions built into DNA's structure, and what I want to talk about next is the fact that the rate or the frequency of transcription to begin gene expression leading to a protein is made at the very end of gene expression. The rate or frequency of this can be influenced by proteins that bind to DNA. You see, DNA is a nucleic acid, it's not a protein. Nucleic acids like DNA are made from nucleotides as their building blocks, versus proteins are made from amino acids as their building blocks. So DNA looks quite different than a protein, but I'm saying that there are proteins that will bind to DNA and influence the rate or frequency of transcription of various genes. These DNA binding proteins are often referred to as transcription factors. They influence the rate of transcription, if you will. They are called transcription factors, and they are DNA binding proteins. In liver cells, this is getting more specifically to the answer for objective 8C. In liver cells, there's a DNA binding protein called cyclic AMP response element binding protein. Cyclic AMP response element binding protein. And an acronym often used for this protein is CREB. I don't know why they don't put a P at the end of that. It's a binding protein. But CREB stands for cyclic AMP response element binding protein. There's no real need for the hyphen in how I spelled that. I'll take that out. Cyclic AMP response element binding protein. It's a DNA binding protein. And how well it influences the rate of transcription depends on its shape. And one way of changing its shape is a phosphorylation of it catalyzed by protein kinase A. So that's the direction I'm taking the story in the liver cell now for objective 8C. In the liver cell, after protein kinase A comes on, and I'm hoping you can explain that, you can connect that to glucagon messages. After protein kinase A comes on, protein kinase A, which I'll abbreviate PKA, that's a fairly standard abbreviation for protein kinase A. After protein kinase A comes on, it will catalyze this phosphorylation reaction where a phosphate group is transferred from ATP to the DNA binding protein, CREB. I guess I'll start to pronounce it CREB, cyclic AMP response element binding protein. And I'll depict that it's been phosphorylated maybe that way now. And I want you to realize that when you put a phosphate group on a protein, this came up big time on Tuesday, that will almost certainly change the protein's shape. You see, phosphate groups are kind of bulky, and they have a lot of negative charge associated with them. Negative charge attracts positive charges and repels negative charges, and protein chains have both positive and negative charges that would be attracted and repulsed by the negative charges of the phosphate. It's kind of understandable, logical to me anyway, in a way I was just trying to describe, that putting a phosphate group on your protein might well change its shape, how it folds. And what happens when this phosphorylation of cyclic AMP response element binding protein occurs is it will speed up the transcription of a gene that codes for one of the enzymes of gluconeogenesis. When the production of an enzyme can be sped up by a mechanism similar to this one, some transcription factor binding to DNA and speeding up transcription, when the production of an enzyme can be sped up by a mechanism like I just described. I will in a second. Let me finish this sentence. When an enzyme... how did I start that sentence? When an enzyme's production can be sped up by this kind of mechanism, it's often referred to as an inducible enzyme. That terminology appears in Objective HC, and I want you to have some understanding of what it means if I call an enzyme or any other protein inducible. What I mean is that the cells that produce the enzyme or protein don't always produce it at the same rate. They speed up their production of it when needed and slow down their production of it when it's not needed. That kind of an enzyme is an inducible enzyme, an enzyme that can have the rate of its production altered as needed. And it always involves, you see, something binding to the DNA. When I speak of a protein or an enzyme as being inducible, that would automatically mean that there's some mechanism by which something binds to DNA and changes the rate of transcription. Transcription of the gene that codes for that protein or enzyme. Now, to answer your question, this time, in this story, I'm talking about an enzyme for gluconeogenesis inside liver cells. And I'm explaining how, in the fasting state, glucagon messages lead to liver cells speeding up their production of this enzyme. Let's assume that the rate of destruction of the enzyme remains constant. I think that's a safe assumption. The rate of destruction of the enzyme remains constant. But we speed up now the rate of its production, altering a balance between these two rates so that now the enzyme is being produced faster than it's being destroyed, and the amount of the enzyme, this is getting to the bottom line of what happens, the amount of the enzyme increases. The amount of the enzyme inside liver cells increases. This is an enzyme for gluconeogenesis. I won't bother you with the enzyme's name right now. Later on, you'll learn the enzymes of gluconeogenesis, and you'll realize the name of this enzyme then. It's a very long name that would only kind of get in the way for me to mention right now. It's an enzyme of gluconeogenesis, which is enough for me to describe now why gluconeogenesis might speed up. A desirable outcome here in the fasting state. Always make that common sense check when you try and tell a story like this one. Does it come out the way you intuitively feel it should come out? If not, maybe you've messed up the story somewhere. it comes out that gluconeogenesis speeds up in liver cells in the fasting state. And my double check here says, yes, that's the direction in which I want things to go. Because this is going to help maintain blood sugar level, you see. Objective number 9. Now that we've talked about glucagon signals and how they work with a couple of specific examples, one example in adipocytes and another example in liver cells, let's talk about how the events that have been set into motion by glucagon signals and what has been said can be terminated or reset back to the beginning again. Let's use this figure, figure 1117 from page 198. Remember, we only followed this figure up to where the cyclic AMP gets made by adenylate cyclase, because the rest of this figure is about how it could reset itself back to the beginning again. And let me help you with reading this diagram. This arrow right here, where you see a piece of I, an inorganic phosphate coming out as a product of that reaction suggested by the arrow, that's a totally different reaction than the reaction that makes cyclic AMP. To back up to part of this diagram that we've already discovered together, the production of cyclic AMP comes from ATP reacting with itself. ATP reacting with itself in a way that makes cyclic AMP, and to explain all of the products of that reaction, I showed you a P piece of I that is very nicely shown in the next figure in the textbook. We looked at this last time to find the reaction that makes cyclic AMP and P piece of I. P piece of I called pyrophosphate. That's this reaction. We've already talked about it. Now this reaction is something different. And I haven't talked about this one until now. This is a reaction where water goes in and breaks this GTP. That's where this inorganic phosphate comes from. This piece of I is coming off of this GTP. It's a water in, piece of I out reaction. It's breaking the GTP into a GDP and a piece of I. Here's the piece of I, we already found it. Now here's the GDP. That used to be a GTP, but it's had one of its phosphates hydrolytically removed. Now, an enzyme that can catalyze breaking GTP that way might be classified as a GTPase. And it's now time to say that the alpha subunit, maybe I should point right here, the alpha subunit of the heterotrimeric G protein introduced on Tuesday is a GTPase. The alpha subunit of the G protein is a GTPase. That will, after a period of time where it's been doing its job of activating adenylate cyclase, it'll put an end to its own activity. The alpha subunit, you see, only has the right shape for activating adenylate cyclase when it has GTP bound to it. And to sort of put an end to its own activity, the alpha subunit will, after a period of time, catalyze breaking the GTP into a GDP and a piece of I. And then the alpha subunit with a GDP attached instead of GTP will no longer have the right shape for activating adenylate cyclase. So here it is now with the wrong shape for activating adenylate cyclase. It's shown by the artist here as coming away from the adenylate cyclase, and the adenylate cyclase no longer being active. And so the production of cyclic AMP kind of naturally comes to a halt this way. Now, what could start it all over again would be more glucagon signals. But in the absence of more glucagon signals, like let's suppose you eat again, fasting and go from fasting state to fed state by eating again. Well, then it would be a time for glucagon signals to kind of disappear for a while, perhaps. And so in the absence of more glucagon signals, we want this sequence of events set in motion by glucagon signals to come to an end somehow. And now we're looking at some of the events that allow it to come to an end. If you look at the very last picture in this diagram and compare it to the very first picture in this diagram, the artist has done a good job, I would say, of suggesting that it goes back to the beginning again. It can reset itself. That last picture is exactly the same as the first picture in the diagram. It has reset itself at that point. The alpha subunit that has GDP attached now will reassociate itself with the beta and gamma subunits. The heterotrimeric G protein with GDP attached comes all back together again and reassociates with the glucagon receptor. We're back to the beginning again. Ready for another glucagon message or not, if the level of glucagon in the blood has gone down. So that's objective 9A. Would be aided by changing the picture to this one for objective 9B. This is figure 1118 on page 200. Suppose you do, as I suggested a moment ago, eat again. And so you go out of the fasting state and rather immediately into the fed state by eating again. Well, then you might expect insulin signals to increase in addition to the glucagon signals decreasing. And insulin signals are often described as rather opposite messages from those delivered by glucagon signals. Blood sugar level is a real clear-cut case where glucagon signals raise blood sugar level and insulin signals lower blood sugar level. So in that case, and in a lot of cases, insulin messages and glucagon messages are conveniently considered to be opposites. And here's a little bit of the biochemistry of how insulin signals can so completely undo everything that glucagon signals set into motion. Remember, the glucagon signals led to an increase in the concentration of cyclic AMP inside the target cells. And that was by glucagon signals leading to activation of this enzyme, adenylate cyclase, activation of that enzyme. Well, insulin signals, in a way that I'm going to leave sort of mysterious because the mechanism, I'm not really prepared to describe it to you. I'm not sure how well it's known yet. But insulin signals are believed by a number of authors to lead to inhibition of adenylate cyclase. Rather than activation of it, inhibition of it. So that's going to slow down the production of cyclic AMP. That would be a way that insulin signals may slow down the production of cyclic AMP. And then to further influence the level of cyclic AMP inside the target cells, insulin signals activate this enzyme. This is a part of this diagram that I haven't found with you yet, even though we visited this diagram before together. We didn't go this far in this diagram. We didn't find this part until now. An enzyme called cyclic AMP phosphodiesterase. The name of that enzyme is trying to tell you that it catalyzes hydrolysis of a phosphodiester linkage in cyclic AMP. So hopefully you paid attention when we looked at cyclic AMP's structure before. If not, here's another chance. Here's cyclic AMP's structure. Here's its full-blown chemical structure, and we also suggested it schematically on Tuesday. And we looked definitely at that point on Tuesday at how this one phosphate is involved in two phosphoester bonds. And so when you consider all of that together, sort of all of this together, the one phosphate involved in two phosphoester bonds, you might see why people describe cyclic AMP as a phosphodiester. That one phosphate involved in two phosphoester bonds. All of this together might be considered a phosphodiester now, and by hydrolyzing that phosphoester bond right there, you're breaking the phosphodiester part of cyclic AMP. That's as good of a job as I can do, I think, of explaining the name of this enzyme, cyclic AMP phosphodiesterase. It catalyzes hydrolysis of cyclic AMP right here, changing cyclic AMP into ordinary AMP. And those are very different to the other molecules inside these cells. AMP doesn't look like cyclic AMP anymore. Most importantly, perhaps, AMP does not activate protein kinase A. Some people call protein kinase A cyclic AMP-dependent protein kinase. That makes good sense. That's a pretty descriptive name for protein kinase A, because we indeed talked about it as being the protein kinase that is activated by cyclic AMP. So cyclic AMP-dependent or cyclic AMP-activated protein kinase. Those names at least reinforce that it's cyclic AMP, not ordinary AMP, but cyclic AMP that activates protein kinase A. So, sort of a double whammy on the level of cyclic AMP inside this cell caused by the insulin signals. Insulin signals inhibiting this enzyme and activating that enzyme leads to this conclusion. Insulin signals both decrease the rate of production of cyclic AMP and increase the rate of destruction of cyclic AMP. So boy, does the level of cyclic AMP come down because of those effects. Quite the opposite of what glucagon messages do to cyclic AMP levels. I was just saying, they've asked me to repeat what I just said, and I was just saying that there's two ways that the insulin signals lead to lowering the level of cyclic AMP versus glucagon messages. They raise the level of cyclic AMP in these target cells. Oh, yes, and one more part to how insulin signals can so totally undo everything that glucagon signals set into motion. Remember that the glucagon signals lead to protein kinase A coming on. And in some of the stories that will follow, let's start with glucagon signals, protein kinase A turns on other protein kinases, sort of a cascade of protein kinases being turned on by glucagon messages. Protein kinases being turned on is sort of the picture I'm thinking you have in your mind about glucagon messages now. And insulin messages turn on some enzymes that will sort of be the opposites of protein kinases. I want to take you back to a picture that we looked at together. It must have been just Tuesday, I guess. That we looked at together in chapter 9. Figure 9.8 from page 147. You'll remember from Tuesday us talking about the reaction that goes from top to bottom here on page 147. And that would be the kind of reaction catalyzed by a protein kinase. I had to tell you about that on Tuesday because I was introducing protein kinase A on Tuesday. Protein kinases change proteins into phosphorylated proteins. And protein, once it's phosphorylated, changes its shape. Well, a way to put that protein back in its original shape again would be a reaction that can take that phosphate off And it's not the reverse of the protein kinase reaction. The exact reverse of the protein kinase reaction would be the phosphorylated protein reacting with ADP to make the protein look the way it did originally and some ATP. It doesn't back up that way. It does not. That reaction, consider it irreversible in the body. It never goes the other direction. So how do you get back to a protein that's dephosphorylated in that original shape again if the reaction catalyzed by a protein kinase is irreversible? Well, don't worry. There's a hydrolysis reaction that is possible. A reaction that occurs quickly enough to be meaningful because it's catalyzed by an enzyme that I would call a protein phosphatase. Now, you learned from me what phosphatases do earlier. So let that work for you again here. Phosphatases catalyze hydrolysis reactions that break phosphoester bonds. There are reactions where water goes in and a piece of I comes out. That's what I expect for any reaction catalyzed by a phosphatase. A water in, P out reaction. Which is kind of easy to remember, isn't it? A water in, P out, piece of I out reaction. That's the kind of reaction catalyzed by phosphatases. And now protein phosphatases would catalyze that kind of reaction starting with a phosphorylated protein and would remove, by the hydrolysis reaction, would remove the phosphate from the phosphorylated protein and put the protein into its dephosphorylated shape. So, because of the existence of both kinds of enzymes, protein kinases and protein phosphatases, we often see proteins in what we'll study all year long that change how well they work in kind of a reversible way. Now, these reactions are not reversible reactions. It takes one kind of reaction to go one direction and a different kind of reaction to go the other direction. But in this way, the protein can go back and forth between a dephosphorylated shape and a phosphorylated shape repeatedly. And it's a very common strategy in biochemistry for controlling activities, it might be said, of the enzyme. Turning them on, turning them back off again, turning them back on, turning them back off again, according to the cellular needs.
So insulin pushes it back towards it releasing the anorganic.
She's bringing me back to the main point being about insulin messages and connecting this to insulin messages, which I will do after, let me listen to another question here.
That's my question.
Okay, yeah, to connect this to insulin messages like you're wanting me to do, that's exactly what I want to do too. Whereas glucagon messages, I said a moment ago, tend to turn on protein kinases and encourage phosphorylations of proteins, insulin messages we're often going to see lead to activations of protein phosphatases. So all the proteins that get phosphorylated in response to glucagon messages can then be dephosphorylated in response to insulin messages. So one more way. Now we've talked about several ways that insulin messages biochemically take a target cell in a different direction than the glucagon messages. They seem like opposites. Insulin messages can completely undo everything that glucagon messages set into motion. There will be other examples. Like one great arena will be the arena of glycogen metabolism. There will be other places for me to talk about these ideas again. They're important ideas that are going to keep coming up. Maybe that's worth saying at this point. That would do it for the fasting state. And now you want to pull out the learning objectives for the tricarboxylic acid cycle. And chapter 20 is going to be the main chapter. The first figure we're going to look at is figure 20.1 from the very beginning of chapter 20. This is page 360. The TCA cycle, you're really not even allowed to call it the TCA cycle until you know what TCA stands for. You know the rule about acronyms in this class. And so TCA stands for tricarboxylic acid cycle. And before that makes much sense, we're going to have to look at the chemical structures of things involved in this pathway and find that some of them are tricarboxylic acids. There are some other so commonly used names for this same pathway that you need to know all three names, I would say, that are commonly used for this pathway. Not only TCA cycle, which stands for tricarboxylic acid cycle, but also citric acid cycle. We're going to find citric acid as being one of the characters involved. Citric acid cycle. And then also, it's commonly named after a person. Treb this time, spelled with a K. The TCA cycle is often called Krebs cycle, where that name comes from a person's name. The cycle involves eight intermediates. I'm in learning objective number two now. Eight intermediates that you need to know in order. So here they are by name. Oxaloacetate, citrate, isocitrate, alpha-ketoglutarate, succinyl-CoA, CoA standing for coenzyme A, succinate, fumarate, malate, that would be the eight intermediates. Now, notice that a step of the cycle like this one here, where succinyl-CoA becomes succinate, would be a step that does not change the total number of intermediates that would be swimming around in this cell. Because one intermediate molecule is used to make the next intermediate molecule. But don't take this cyclic depiction of the pathway too seriously. We're not really talking about reactions that occur in a circle. The enzymes are not organized in that kind of way. We're not talking about succinyl-CoA needing to become succinate before there's any succinate to become fumarate. The more realistic situation for you to be picturing is that in this cell compartment, there's a certain number of succinates swimming around rather randomly, and a certain number of every other intermediate swimming around rather randomly at the same time. All of these intermediates present at their own concentrations. Now, this cell compartment that I'm talking about is the very innermost compartment of a mitochondria. That's often called the mitochondrial matrix. In biochemistry, that's what the matrix refers to. It refers to the innermost compartment of a mitochondrion. And sometimes it might just be called the matrix. It's always the mitochondrial matrix that we need in biochemistry class. And it's not as if every succinyl-CoA in that matrix has to become succinate. That's not the only possible fate for it. There are other fates that succinyl-CoAs can undergo instead. So some succinyl-CoAs do this, but other succinyl-CoAs do something else altogether. It's a more random situation than first one of these becomes one of those, and then one of these becomes one of those, and everybody's organized in a circle. Don't read the circular depiction too literally. But realize that these reactions could go round and round and round and not change the total number of cycle intermediates. For every turn of the cycle, an oxaloacetate is used and an oxaloacetate is produced. The number of oxaloacetates stays the same. For every turn of the cycle, the number of a particular intermediate is not changed by a turn of the cycle. She's wondering, do the reactions have to happen in this order? And I'm saying that at the same time that some citrates are turning into isocitrates, there can be some succinates turning into fumarates, because there's some succinates already. You don't have to wait for it to come around to you. That's sort of what I was saying. That sounded like I was saying things could happen out of order. I think I should say that you need to know what you said you needed to know. We get pretty detailed in our look at the Krebs cycle now. I'm hoping you remember the framework that's been established, where Krebs cycle is, or the TCA cycle is what we usually called it, is important in the aerobic use of fuel molecules. Acetyl-CoA is going into the TCA cycle, is how we've seen this already. As a part of cellular respiration. And now, you might say the class is getting harder. We're going to be very detailed in our look at this pathway. So yes, keep track of the carbons. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if we'd be able to draw it or...
I want you to be able to draw what you see right here, for sure.
Okay.
When it comes to the structures, chemical structures of intermediates, then I back off. There's some of them I make you draw, and some of them I never do.
Okay.
I try and make you learn the structures that, by learning them, your life gets easier. Notice the number of carbons, which she made me think about, are indicated. Oxaloacetate is a molecule with four carbons. Citrate is a molecule with six carbons. The number of carbons for each intermediate is noted. And one of the last points I made was that turning of the cycle doesn't really change the number of intermediates. For every turn of the cycle, one is used and one is made. It was a point I was making a moment ago. So what is consumed by the turning of the cycle? Well, we can gain some insight by finding this net reaction down at the bottom here. I see that for every turn of the cycle, an acetyl-CoA is used. Oh yeah, now I'm remembering what I've seen in earlier maps this quarter. Acetyl-CoA giving an acetyl group to the TCA cycle. That would be two carbons going into the TCA cycle. It's adding up for me now that the oxaloacetate with four carbons can become something with six carbons by gaining those two right there, the two carbons of the acetyl group. So for every turn of the cycle, an acetyl group is going to be consumed. Two carbons are going to go in. How does it end up that if this sequence of reactions occurs, we end up back where we started with something that's only four carbons big? Well, here's where I find carbons coming out of the cycle. Sort of corresponding to the fact that two carbons go in per turn, here's two carbons coming out, not from the very same step, but from one step right after the other. Two carbons coming out per turn of the cycle. That's how we get back to having the same number of carbons again. And so I'm finding in the net reaction two related facts, I would say, the consumption of an acetyl group and the production of two carbon dioxides per turn of the cycle.
And then here's some things that need to be introduced at this point, or in these learning objectives anyway, that are consumed by the cycle. For every turn of the cycle, there's three NAD pluses. And you're not allowed to call them NAD pluses unless you know that that stands for nicotinamide adenine dinucleotides. And for every turn of the cycle, one FAD is consumed or altered, changed. FAD stands for flavine adenine dinucleotide. And yes, we will be introducing that with the help of these learning objectives. These are going to be things that pick up electrons from carbons of cycle intermediates. And when they gain electrons, when the NAD pluses and the FAD gain electrons, they themselves are being reduced to the reduced forms of them that we find on the product side of this net reaction. Here's the three NAD pluses having been reduced to NADHs. That's the reduced form. An NADH, you see, has two more electrons that it has gained compared to an NAD plus. And the FAD gains two electrons and is reduced to the form you see on the product side. FAD2H, or another common way to denote that is FADH with a subscript of 2 for the 2Hs. Oh boy, that's a stylistic thing. It doesn't matter a bit. Some people write FAD, a lot of people write FADH2 for the reduced form of flavine adenine dinucleotide. Your textbook, I think in the caption of this diagram, they explain their bias. Your textbook likes to say FAD2H. It doesn't matter. Choose either style you want. That's the reduced form of flavine adenine dinucleotide. It has two electrons that FAD doesn't have. FAD2H has two electrons that it has picked up from. Well, I can tell right here that it takes those electrons from succinate. So here's a step of the pathway where succinate gives up electrons, and an FAD that's understood to be going into that reaction gains electrons. The succinate in that process is oxidized to fumarate, and the FAD that is understood to be going in, you might want to draw it in, the FAD going into this reaction gets reduced to FAD2H. You see, we start throwing around the redox terminology rather freely at this point. And you've got to be right on top of the redox terminology. And I'm pretty good, actually, pretty practiced at helping someone master all the different ways that people use redox terminology. Even the tricky terms where you start talking about what kind of an agent something is. Is it an oxidizing agent or a reducing agent? Where you're no longer talking about what happens to it, you're talking about what it does to something else. Boy, is that tricky. And the whole idea of gaining electrons being reduction, that drives people nuts too. How can gaining something be reduction? That's not how we use the term in everyday language. How can gaining something be reduction? And I try and make it a little more palatable by saying, well, electrons are negative. So if you gain something negative, can you think of that as reduction? And sometimes that works. But anyway, give me a chance. Don't hide from me. This redox terminology never goes away. And starting with the second test this quarter, there's almost bound to be at least one redox question on every test for the whole year long now, where I ask you, who's the oxidizing agent? Who's the reducing agent? And that kind of thing.
So when you're talking about NAD becoming NADH and FAD becoming FAD2H, are those the electrons gained in that process what goes into the electron transport chain?
Yes.
That's the purpose of this.
She is realizing something that figure 20.3 will clue us into, that when the NAD pluses become NADHs, or when the FAD becomes an FAD2H, that those electrons can then find themselves in the electron transport chain. These are the electron carriers that will make the connection that you already kind of realized between the TCA cycle and the electron transport chain. So far, we've been saying in this class that the TCA cycle takes electrons from fuel molecules and can send them, the electrons that is, to the electron transport chain. And now you're starting to realize who the electron carriers are in that process. The NAD pluses that become NADHs and can then go back to being NAD pluses again by giving electrons to the electron transport chain. And the FADs that become FAD2Hs and then go back to being FADs again by giving electrons to the electron transport chain is how these electrons are going to reach the electron transport chain. So introducing these electron carriers was an important task that you find in these learning objectives. They have some interesting connections to vitamins. So we begin to realize why some vitamins are needed with this material. Now, this depiction here, now that I've shown you figure 20.3, in addition to figure 20.1, we've got another depiction of the TCA cycle here in figure 20.3. This depiction shows the electron transport chain and the rest of oxidative phosphorylation as if it's in the middle of this circle, and that's the wrong idea. They weren't realizing how they might mislead a brand new student for this material. The electron transport chain and the rest of oxidative phosphorylation are in the, I think I've asked you to know this already, they're in the inner mitochondrial membrane. You see, mitochondria have two membranes, an outer membrane and an inner membrane. And what I just called the matrix a few minutes ago is the innermost compartment. So what's enveloped by the inner mitochondrial membrane, the things that swim around in that space enveloped by the inner mitochondrial membrane, the innermost room in a mitochondria, and that's the matrix. Now that I've got you thinking about the membrane that surrounds the matrix, the inner mitochondrial membrane, I've got you thinking about where the electron transport chain and the rest of oxidative phosphorylation actually resides. So maybe a better picture would have been to try to suggest the inner mitochondrial membrane enveloping the reactions that you see for the TCA cycle. And the electron transport chain and the rest of oxidative phosphorylation are in that inner mitochondrial membrane. One other aspect, let me back up to our first picture again. One other aspect that I find in this net reaction to pay some attention to is the fact that per turn of the cycle, one molecule of GTP is produced. That's by a reaction of the cycle that puts a GDP and a piece of I together. It's this reaction right here, where succinyl-CoA becomes succinate, that a GDP and a piece of I would probably write that in, a piece of I, a GDP and a piece of I come together to make a GTP. So now I've explained most of the things that you see going in per turn of the cycle, except the waters. I don't care if you know about that or not. I don't try and keep track of every water in metabolism. It would drive me crazy if I did. So I don't need you to know that there's two waters spent per turn of the cycle. But I think the rest of what goes in, you should know that one acetyl-CoA and three NAD pluses and one FAD and then a GDP and a piece of I, those things would go in per turn of the cycle. And then to start to locate the steps where those things happen. And turning our attention to the product side, I would want you to know 2 carbon dioxides per turn of the cycle come out, and 3 NADHs and 1 FAD2H, those have been explained, and the GTP has been explained. I don't care about these protons, if you know that 3 protons are produced per turn of the cycle or not. Let me get to the same kind of thing I said about water when it comes to protons. I don't try to keep track of every proton in metabolism. I did try once and stopped just before I went crazy. You might say I went too far, and I actually did go crazy. But I found that it saved my sanity somewhat to back off from trying to keep track of every proton in metabolism. But I think I've pointed out what I consider now to be the main features of that net reaction that I would want you to know. She's noticing that when NADH is made by this step, or this step, or this step, those are the 3 steps where I see NADH is made, she's noticed that they say NADH plus H plus. And this is related to what I was just saying about what I try to keep track of and what I don't. You see, for example, when the malate becomes oxaloacetate, the malate loses 2 H's. The malate loses 2 H's. We're going to look at that reaction with chemical structures and make it very clear to you. I'll do that after the break today, I suppose. The malate loses 2 H's, is what we'll see when we look at the chemical structures. But only 1 of those H's is gained by the NAD+. This is the H gained by the NAD+, as the NAD+ turns into NADH. And that H has 2 electrons that came with it from the malate. That H, the one gained by the NAD+, is a hydride ion, meaning an H with 2 electrons. And it's the electrons I want to keep track of. It's the electrons that are going to enable this cell to produce some ATP by sending the electrons to the electron transport chain and such. It's the electrons I want to keep track of. And the other H lost by the malate floats off into the surrounding water. It's a proton in the surrounding aqueous medium. And I don't try to keep track of that. It would drive me crazy to try to keep track of that H plus. So I admit to, and maybe I shouldn't apologize to the protons of the world, but I admit to ignoring them quite frequently. So if you want to show NADH plus H plus as products, fine. But the one I care about is NADH. That's the one I'm going to try to keep track of. That's the one that has some electrons to give. He's remembering that the electron transport chain pumps some protons across the inner mitochondrial membrane to create a gradient. And even those protons are awfully hard to keep track of. And anybody with sanity has given up. You'll find the exact source of those protons that are pumped are not entirely known. Some of them just come from the aqueous medium on one side of the membrane and get pumped to the aqueous medium on the other side. And keeping track of those protons is awfully hard to do. Let's take our 10-minute break at this point. Oh, it's time for me to remember to spread out your test. Say there's already acetic acid or acetate as is in vinegar. And then another place it can come from is from your body's metabolism of ethanol. We'll talk about ethanol metabolism in the third quarter. That's another place that the acetate could possibly come from. Well, the next level of sophistication after this diagram for examining the TCA cycle would be figure 20.3, where instead of just names, it's going to show us chemical structures. And for the steps of the cycle, the eight steps of the cycle, it's going to name the enzymes for us as well. Those are major increased sophistication aspects of the next diagram. We find chemical structures and the names of the enzymes in the next depiction. So here's acetyl-CoA with a box around the acetyl group. And I think it's time we learned a little bit more about the coenzyme A part of acetyl-CoA. This S right here is a sulfuron of coenzyme A's structure. Let's see, did the previous diagram show us the structure? No, it didn't. But this figure, figure 20.2, shows us acetyl-CoA. Here's the acetyl group. Here's the coenzyme A part, however, highly abbreviated, where the only atom shown explicitly of the CoA part is that sulfur. Evidently, that sulfur atom of coenzyme A is maybe its most important atom when it comes to carrying acetyl groups. But what's the rest of coenzyme A look like? Well, let's go to a picture on page 127. Page 127 is in chapter 8, and that's where you can see a lot of coenzymes, like acetyl coenzyme, like coenzyme A. So here's all of coenzyme A's structure, and you don't need to try and memorize it. I would never ask you to draw that. We'll pretty quickly go back to abbreviating most of that structure. COA, coenzyme A.
Just going back to learning objective number 2, because I really started to move on to 3. It asks about carbon dioxide elimination, and I'm just wondering, is that all through diffusion, that it ends up in the bloodstream and goes out?
Can I return to that later rather than trying to do it right now?
Yeah.
Remind me if I don't ever do it to come back to that. I am indeed, I guess, now dealing with part of learning objective 3, and she's asking me to finish learning objective 2. And I beg for permission to finish learning objective 2 later. Learning objective 3, we're looking at coenzyme A's structure here on page 127. Many people have turned to this page now. And here's the sulfur atom of coenzyme A. When coenzyme A does not have an acetyl group or anything else attached to it, that sulfur atom is the sulfur of an SH group. So here's coenzyme A's SH group. The part of that structure that has the SH group in it, all of this right here, all of this part of coenzyme A's structure, came from the amino acid that has been introduced in class already. An amino acid that's kind of special because of the sulfur or the SH group in its structure. I'm having you remember this amino acid one more time. Cysteamine is how I pronounce it. That part of coenzyme A's structure comes from a cysteamine. The sulfur, the SH group, comes from cysteamine. And that's maybe the most important part of coenzyme A when it comes to carrying groups like acetyl groups. This part of coenzyme A's structure comes from a B vitamin called pantothenic acid. Whenever we have an acid with an ick acid ending, feel free if you want to change the ick acid ending of its name to an eight ending and call it pantothenic. It's kind of like lactic acid and lactate are the same thing in biochemistry class. And pantothenic acid and pantothenate are the same thing in biochemistry class. We allow you to use either the ick acid ending or the eight ending, whichever you prefer. Let me give it one more name. This B vitamin, pantothenic acid or pantothenate, many people call it vitamin B5. But know its other name, pantothenic acid as well, is knowing it as vitamin B5. The B number designations are slowly falling into disfavor, people wanting you to know the other names instead. So vitamin B5 and pantothenic acid, at this point, I think you need to know them both as meaning the same thing. This part of the structure should look like a nucleotide to you. In fact, that's adenine. That's the purine adenine right there. And this is ribose. There's a phosphate attached to ribose right there. And then here's some other phosphates attached to where we're used to seeing phosphates attached to ribose in nucleotide structures. And this part of the structure came from ATP. So now I've sort of told you where all its pieces came from. Realize, please, that coenzyme A, this is the best time to look at its structure and to appreciate this. Coenzyme A is not a protein. That structure is not a string of amino acids joined by peptide bonds. There was only one amino acid piece to it that I mentioned, and that would be this part right here that came from cysteine. When I look at its entire structure, it's not made up of amino acids joined by peptide bonds. It's not a protein. Whereas enzymes are almost always going to be proteins, coenzymes never are. Coenzymes are not proteins. Coenzymes, by definition, are non-protein helpers, I might call them. They often assist some protein in doing its job. So they help some proteins do their jobs, but the coenzyme itself is a non-protein helper. It's not a protein. And as illustrated by this example of a coenzyme, often when a non-protein helper is called a coenzyme, it has a vitamin that contributes part of its structure. It's derived from a vitamin. It's got some connection to a vitamin, in that a vitamin is a part of its structure. So that's the usual idea of a coenzyme, a non-protein helper with a vitamin as a part of its structure. Now look at what it says up here about the job that coenzyme A does in metabolism. Coenzyme A is going to remain an important player in just about all the pathways we talk about this quarter and next quarter. Boy, coenzyme A never goes away. So let's talk already about the job that it does consistently, to see something consistent about its function. It carries acyl groups using that sulfur right there. Like when acetyl-CoA carries an acetyl group for the purpose of delivering the acetyl group to the TCA site. That's the example that's right in front of us right now, is acetyl-CoA carries an acetyl group and gives it to the TCA site. Well, to speak more generally about all the places we're going to find coenzyme A functioning in metabolism, it will carry, coenzyme A will carry some acyl group and donate the acyl group to some place where it's needed. So now we're dealing with the difference between acetyl groups and acyl groups. I think I've tried this with you already, but it's time to really hammer on the point this time, that they're different things. The acetyl group is what I drew right here. And there it is attached to the sulfur atom of coenzyme A. So that's acetyl coenzyme A. But more generally, coenzyme A carries groups that look like this, where the R can vary. That's my way of generalizing about an acyl group. I would circle all of this, including the carbon that's doubly bonded to oxygen, and say that's an acyl group in general. And when I tried to define acyl groups for you in class once before, it went something like this. Acyl groups are groups that, upon hydrolysis, would give you a carboxylic acid. So let's imagine hydrolysis of this linkage right here between the acyl group and the sulfur of coenzyme A. A bond, a hydrolyzable bond that I might call, I'm going to want you to be able to apply this label, a thioester bond. That's what they say right here, isn't it? Forms thioesters with acyl groups. And there's their representation of an acyl group. I've kind of reproduced what they have here. A thioester bond is a hydrolyzable bond. And I define acyl groups as groups that upon hydrolysis would give you a carboxylic acid. It first came up in the context of the structures of fat molecules. Remember us calling them triacyl glycerols? That was my first mention of acyl groups to you guys. But now you're starting to realize, if you didn't already, that acyl groups come in all shapes and sizes. From little dinky acetyl groups that are only two carbons big, to fatty acyl groups that are 20 carbons big or longer, and all kinds of shapes and sizes in between. Here's what acyl groups always have in common. Here's the definition for acyl groups. They're attached by a hydrolyzable bond, and upon hydrolysis, you get a carboxylic acid from an acyl group. To illustrate that, let's imagine hydrolysis of this thioester bond to release the acyl group as a carboxylic acid. And that would also release the coenzyme A from its attachment to the acyl group. So the other product here would be coenzyme A all by itself. In other words, what this chemical structure is showing us. Coenzyme A all by itself would be the other product of this hydrolysis reaction. And now here's some symbolism and some terminology for us to get past. So give it your best shot right now, and maybe it won't be a struggle for you in the future. Coenzyme A all by itself represented three different ways here. HSCOA, or turn it around, COASH. That would represent coenzyme A all by itself, where the only atoms that you're showing explicitly are the SH atoms. And you're representing the rest of coenzyme A with the COA. And it doesn't matter whether you put the SH group on the left or on the right. Those would both be read by a biochemist as meaning coenzyme A. And then here's a nice shortcut. If you don't like showing the SH group, you don't have to. You could just say COA. And that means the same thing as COASH. COASH and COA are ways of representing coenzyme A all by itself. When it forms a linkage to an acyl group, it lets go of the H from the SH group. That allows the sulfur to have a spot for this attachment to be a seal cleave. The attachment, that hydrolyzable attachment between a sulfur and an acyl group, is a thioester bond. Thio, you see, is a prefix that means sulfur in the place of oxygen. Thio is a prefix that means sulfur in the place of oxygen. So, when you have an acyl group attached to the sulfur of coenzyme A, it's like an ester bond, but with a sulfur right here instead of an oxygen. Or to work towards an even better definition of a thioester bond, let's again look at what you get upon hydrolysis. A thioester bond upon hydrolysis gives you an acid. And if this was an ordinary ester, you'd say an acid and an alcohol. But because it's a thioester with sulfur in the place of one of the oxygens, you don't get an alcohol with an OH group. Instead, you get something with an SH group, a sulfur in the place of an oxygen, not an ordinary alcohol with an OH group, but a thio alcohol with an SH group. You see, I circled the SH group of coenzyme A, and here's the terminology I'm trying to introduce. The SH group of something like coenzyme A is called a sulfhydryl group. Sulfhydryl just speaks of sulfur and hydrogen, SH. But the molecules that possess an SH group, like coenzyme A is a good example, those might be classified as thioalcohols. They're like alcohols, but with sulfur in the place of oxygen. Thioalcohols. And then, finally, some people shorten thioalcohol into one word, and they call it a thiol. A thiol is a thioalcohol. It has a sulfhydryl group. And now back to why this is a thioester bond. It's a thioester bond because upon hydrolysis, you get an acid and a thiol. I had to get through a lot of terminology, introduce a lot of terminology to say it's now that succinctly. But here it is again, my most succinct yet, I guess, definition of a thioester bond. A thioester bond upon hydrolysis gives an acid and a thiol. So be ready now to see coenzyme A over and over again in metabolism carrying some kind of acyl group. The first acyl group that you were ready to hear about, perhaps being carried by coenzyme A, is the acetyl group. But notice, here's another kind of acyl group attached to coenzyme A as one of the intermediates of the TCA cycle, succinyl coenzyme A. I'm thinking that maybe with today's introduction and discussion of coenzyme A, you would guess that succinyl CoA involves succinyl as an acyl group attached to coenzyme A's sulfur by a thioester bond. This next figure might show us a little bit of a structure here. Here's succinyl-CoA in figure 20.3, where I can see the full chemical structure of the succinyl group. I can see that it's four carbons big. I can see how right here it's joined by a thioester bond to coenzyme A's sulfur. Here's what succinyl-CoA looks like without having to draw out the coenzyme A part. It does allow me to see the succinyl group as an acyl group. carried by coenzyme A here. And I've suggested that you had already heard of acyl groups in the context of fatty acyl groups. Well, now I can say that for fatty acyl groups to be used in a cell, coenzyme A needs to be attached to them. Before a fatty acid can be used as fuel, for example. And the pathway for that was introduced, the name of the pathway for that was introduced recently, so here's a chance to recall. What's the name of the pathway for using fatty acids as fuel? Some of you said it. Beta oxidation. For a cell to use a fatty acid as fuel, the fatty acid has to be attached to coenzyme A. It's got to be a fatty acyl group attached to coenzyme A. It needs to be a fatty acyl CoA. That's the real starting point for beta oxidation. So be ready to see coenzyme A carry a variety of acyl groups and to, in that way, prove itself needed in a lot of the pathways we talked about. Be ready to see it carry a variety of acyl groups. Now, back to finishing learning objective number two, before I forget. There is indeed, as your classmate pointed out, a part of learning objective two about the carbon dioxide and how it's eliminated from the body, the very last sentence of objective number two. I'm talking about this carbon dioxide and this carbon dioxide, where the carbons are already as oxidized as they can get. They're not worth any more energy to a cell and are often considered at this point to be a waste product that needs to be eliminated from the body. And this might be the TCA cycle happening in a muscle cell in my calf muscle. Gastrocnemius or soleus, one of those calf muscles. And yet, for me to eliminate the carbon dioxide being produced there, I've got to get the carbon dioxide from there to my lungs for exhalation. So, really what I wanted to tell you is a couple of ways that the carbon dioxide produced can travel in the bloodstream to the lungs for exhalation. Most of the carbon dioxide travels in the bloodstream in this form, bicarbonate ion. And how it gets from being carbon dioxide to being that form, bicarbonate ion, is a way that involves an enzymatic reaction, a reaction between carbon dioxide and water that makes carbonic acid. The enzyme that catalyzes this reaction is called carbonic anhydrase. And then the carbonic acid produced will, without the need for any enzyme, will ionize to produce bicarbonate ion. So, bicarbonate ion in biochemistry is conveniently thought of as another form of carbon dioxide. That reaction catalyzed by carbonic anhydrase is reversible. Everything I described here is reversible, and so carbon dioxide and bicarbonate ion can be thought of as just two different forms of the same thing. And the carbon dioxide produced in my calf muscle could be converted into bicarbonate ion and then swim freely as bicarbonate ion in the bloodstream until it reaches capillaries in my lungs, and there it can go back to being carbon dioxide again and be exhaled is carbon dioxide. That's how most of the carbon dioxide makes it out of the body. Let's say about 85% of the carbon dioxide makes it to the lungs by turning into bicarbonate ion. The rest, the remaining 15% of the carbon dioxide, makes it to the lungs by attaching covalently to hemoglobin molecules inside of red blood cells. But that's reversible too. The covalent attachment to hemoglobin molecules inside red blood cells is reversible. So when the red blood cells reach capillaries in the lungs, those carbon dioxides can let go of the hemoglobin molecules inside the red blood cells and be exhaled as carbon dioxide. This discussion will come up again, but not until third quarter when I take some time to talk about hemoglobin. And so now, I think we've done objectives 1 through 3, and we can go on to objective 4. Objective 4 has several parts, parts A, B, C, and D, where in all of those, we're considering the redox reactions of the TCA cycle. The redox reactions. There are 8 reactions in the cycle, but only 4 of them are redox reactions. And those are the ones that I think are the most important for us to focus on. I might ask you to know a little bit beyond these 4 steps of the TCA cycle, but very definitely I think these are the 4 most important steps of the cycle. The redox steps, where some electrons are taken from a cycle intermediate and are given to one of these electron carriers. So let's go back to chapter 20 again, like this depiction here of the TCA cycle. Let's find the 4 redox steps. Those would be the steps where you see either an NADH produced or an FAD2H produced. Here in figure 20.3, there's a slight typo right here. It's as if the typesetter got caught in between 2 different ways of representing the reduced form of flavine adenine dinucleotide. They've got too many H's there. Get rid of the first H, I would say, and leave it saying just FAD2H. That would fix that typo. It's in the steps that make NADH or FAD2H. It's in those steps that some redox chemistry occurs. Some electrons are taken from the cycle intermediate and given to an electron carrier. If I look at the enzyme names, the writing here is too light, I suppose, for you to read it from where you're sitting, but hopefully you've got your book open, or somebody near you has their book open to page 362, so that you can read the enzyme names. The enzymes that catalyze the redox steps all have names that end in the word dehydrogenase. And boy, do we encounter a lot of dehydrogenases. This is just my first opportunity to try and generalize about dehydrogenases for you, so that when you encounter dehydrogenases from now on, you automatically will know something about the reactions that they catalyze. Dehydrogenases catalyze reactions that are at least in part, redox. Now maybe that's not a tremendous amount of information given to you by their name. But to be safe and to offer a definition here that includes all dehydrogenases, I've got to be that vague or that general. I can't really say anything more specific than this. Dehydrogenases catalyze reactions that are at least in part redox. So you know there's some redox aspect to the reaction, that's about all you know, from the name being blah, 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 dehydrogenase. But it often works this well. Malate dehydrogenase, that's the one I wanted to start with. Malate dehydrogenase catalyzes oxidation of malate. And after we talk about malate dehydrogenase and succinate dehydrogenase, actually I'm going to start here. Succinate dehydrogenase catalyzes oxidation of succinate. Then I'm going to talk about malate dehydrogenase. I do have a particular order in which I want to describe these redox reactions. Succinate dehydrogenase catalyzes oxidation of succinate. Malate dehydrogenase catalyzes oxidation of malate. And isocitrate dehydrogenase catalyzes oxidation of isocitrate. And then I'm saving this one for last because it's the most complex. Alpha-ketoglutarate dehydrogenase catalyzes oxidation of alpha-ketoglutarate. So I can tell that just from the enzymes' names, that they catalyze oxidations of the cycle intermediates that their names refer to. Let's take them more one at a time now, the way parts A, B, C, and D will have us do. This is learning objective number 4, part A, where I'm first going to consider the reaction that involves FAD as an oxidizing agent. In other words, the reaction catalyzed by succinate dehydrogenase. It's a reaction that oxidizes succinate but reduces FAD to FAD2H. You see, a redox reaction always works that way, where there's somebody who gives up electrons and somebody else who accepts electrons. So one thing is oxidized and the other thing is reduced. When I speak of FAD as an oxidizing agent, I'm not talking about what happens to it. When I speak of what kind of an agent something is, using redox terminology, I'm not talking about what happens to it. I'm talking about what it does to the other reactor. So when I speak of FAD as an oxidizing agent, I'm saying that the FAD causes the succinate to be oxidized. And what would always happen to an oxidizing agent like the FAD is it itself gets reduced. So the FAD, the oxidizing agent for this reaction, gets reduced to FAD2H. Now, you can even see a couple of H's or hydrogens being lost by the succinate in this reaction. So calling the enzyme succinate dehydrogenase makes great sense. You see, for succinate to go from being a carbon-carbon single bond right here in the middle to being a carbon-carbon double bond, the way it is in the product fumarate, requires that those couple of carbons in the middle each lose an H. And with those H's, electrons are lost as well. But I actually see losing two H's in a reaction catalyzed in the reaction catalyzed by this dehydrogenase. But what's going to be tricky as we go on to other examples of reactions catalyzed by dehydrogenases is that eventually we're going to see somewhere and you don't find any H's lost. Yet the enzyme is still called blah 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 dehydrogenase. So I guess I'm trying to warn you. Don't always expect to see a loss of H's. Many times you will, and that'll be gratifying, because the enzyme's name is blah, 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 dehydrogenase, and seeing lots of H's is somewhat gratifying, but let me warn you that you won't always find them. All you really know for sure from the enzyme's name being blah, 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 dehydrogenase, is that the reaction it catalyzes is at least in part redox. But you don't always see a loss of H's. Before I go on to some of the other redox steps in the cycle, let me pay close attention to what flavine, adenine, dinucleotide looks like. FAD, the oxidizing agent, and also what it looks like after it gets reduced in that reaction catalyzed by succinate dehydrogenase. So the very next figure in the textbook, this is on page 364, shows us flavine, adenine, dinucleotide, and I suppose this is probably the last picture I'll look at today. Let's get a good look at flavine, adenine, dinucleotide as our last goal today. Here's its full chemical structure. Some people might call it a coenzyme. It's not a protein. It's a non-protein helper. And it does have a vitamin in its structure. It's derived from a vitamin. So it might be called a coenzyme or a cofactor. If I call something a cofactor, I'm talking again about a non-protein helper. Cofactors will always be non-protein. They won't be protein. But to look at what it is, if it's not a protein, what is it? Well, here's part of it that comes from a vitamin. The vitamin is riboflavin, which is sometimes called vitamin B2. Please know both names. Riboflavin is the same thing as vitamin B2. And then when a phosphate gets added to that by the body, you might say that we've turned it into a nucleotide. It's kind of a stretch, maybe, of nucleotide, but it's close enough that I'm okay with it. This looks like a heterocyclic nitrogenous base. It's not a purine or a pyrimidine, but it is a heterocyclic nitrogenous base, this part of the riboflavin's structure. And then this part, these five carbons right here with their OH groups, this part is a close relative of ribose. It's not exactly ribose. It's something called ribitol. But it's a very close relative to ribose. So, okay, I'm willing to work with them here. That's a heterocyclic nitrogenous base attached to something a lot like ribose. And then here's a phosphate. So that's like a nucleotide right there. And then if you add all of this to what's been described thus far, that's even more obviously a nucleotide. There's adenine, there's ribose, there's a phosphate. This is a part of the structure that came from an ATP. And now I'm seeing everything for a nucleotide twice in this structure. There's essentially a nucleotide. I'm okay with calling that a nucleotide. And then this is very much a nucleotide. I see a dinucleotide here. I've tried to explain why it's a dinucleotide. And then the heterocyclic nitrogenous bases involved are, well, this part's called flavin. This part of riboflavin is called flavin. And this is adenine. So the heterocyclic nitrogenous bases involved in this dinucleotide are flavin and adenine. Now let's put the name together, or at least we've gotten some meaning about the structure from the name. Flavin, adenine, dinucleotide. This is its oxidized form, and where it's going to change as it gains electrons is up here at the top. And let's skip right by what it looks like after it's gained only one electron. I'm going to ignore that structure to jump all the way over to here to what it looks like in its fully reduced form after gaining two electrons. What we're calling FADH2 or FAD2H. That's the fully reduced form of flavin, adenine, dinucleotide. It has two more electrons than the fully oxidized form that we looked at on the left side. When they came to redrawing it over here on the right side, they suggested most of the structure with an arb roof. Oh, cheaters, cheaters. But then if you want to see what the arb roof is, you can look over here. And actually, I should commend them in what they've done. By using an arb roof here, they've drawn your eyes to the part that changes. When it undergoes a reduction to FAB2H, it's up here that changes. It does gain a couple of H's. But more importantly than gaining H's, it gained some electrons. It gained, with those two H's, it gained two electrons. And it can give those two electrons to the electron transport chain. That's how it'll go back to being FAD again. But the electrons will make it to the electron transport chain, and I think you understand the significance of that. So let's quit today. Thank you very much.
Yeah, these five.